I'm not a bad guy. I'm not a good guy. I'm the guy.
Roman Reigns, he's dressed like a prison guard. Roman Reigns, his promos are on flashcards.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
He used it again. I said last week, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't kill it dead. He should not be using it every single week. So what do? They have him use it again on Raw. And in the Raw Rewind on SmackDown, they replayed him saying the line. Because one time wasn't enough. I cringe now when he says that line. And I want to give credit to the Smart Mark roommates, that little clip you heard there at the end with the Roman Reigns lyrics. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned that on the live show that we did at Frankie's in Dallas. I had heard about it before, but I couldn't remember at the time who did it. Those are the guys responsible. They put lyrics in Roman Reigns' theme song. You can check them out at facebook.com/smartmarkroommates. This is episode 436 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 17, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. Audible continues to offer listeners of this podcast a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. You can sign up right now using our URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. If you do so, you get one free audiobook with your sign-up. So even if you cancel the trial for any reason, in those 30 days, it's not your thing, what have you, you don't get charged, you get to keep your free audiobook. And they've got a ton of wrestling books up there. Brock Lesnar, Chris Jericho, Shawn Michaels, Hulk Hogan, Daniel Bryan, JTG. We've had JTG on the show recently talking about his new book, among other things. His first book is narrated by him, and it's available on Audible. You can cash in for that if you want to. So take advantage. audibletrial.com/solidmonster is the link to use for that. Also, don't forget, we have our store up on prowrestlingtees.com. You can navigate over there. And I've been posting a lot of photos on my Twitter and retweeting some of yours of people. Once you get your shirt, if you wear it, if you take a picture with it, if you go and meet a wrestler somewhere at a convention, an autograph signing, if you want to try to get your photo taken wearing a Sound Off shirt with another wrestler, I've been tweeting a bunch of those photos. So if you do buy a shirt and you want to send it to me or tweet it to me, I'll be more than happy to retweet it out to everybody else at Solid Monster, so you can do that. And if you like what you hear each week, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolidmonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. Thank you this week to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Ladies Man Levi Daly, Nash the Gravedigger Degolato, the Australian Ass Kicker Anthony Patty, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, The Chosen Son, Andre Smith, Tony the Tiger Boylan, Demonic Devin Laney, Rolex Robin Party, Nathaniel Hell on Earth Hayden, Tom Bodybag Hemstock, the 5-year-old Firecracker, Evan Hernandez, the Rebel, Stanton Riker IV, Monster Mac, Matthew Desman, Taylor Hardbody Harden, and Silvertongue Alan Shaw, who hosts the Fighting With My Brothers podcast. And as the title would suggest, it's three brothers. They gather around their mother's kitchen table to talk about pro wrestling and MMA. It's an interesting concept. You can find the show on iTunes. So thank you to him and everybody else who made a donation this week. We're going to do something kind of fun. We're going to have ourselves a little PayPal rumble. I've got so many names here and so many nicknames. So for the people who donate the usual $10 or more between now and next week's show, so between now and next Sunday morning, and you know what? I'll include all the folks who donated this week as well. We'll throw them in there too. On the podcast next weekend, I'll do a random drawing, and the winner gets a Sound Off shirt. So it's basically the same way that we did this for the Royal Rumble pool that we did back in January, where the winner of that on our Facebook group got a shirt. You can pick any design you want from our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. You'll just have to let me know your size. if you want the soft cotton or not, and also where I'm sending it to. I don't have any of the shirts here with me. I think some people think I've got like boxes of free shirts here. I don't have any here with me other than the one I bought for myself. I have to buy it off the website myself and just have it shipped to you instead of having it shipped to me. Very simple. So we'll do that next weekend here on the podcast. Adam Rose and Connor of the Ascension have each been suspended 60 days for what WWE.com says is their second violation of the WWE wellness policy. Connor was apparently suspended many years ago when he was still in Deep South, which tells you how far back this guy goes. He was in their developmental system going back over 10 years. It's a long time. And Adam Rose, I couldn't find anything on a previous wellness suspension for Adam Rose, but you get 30 days for a first one. He got 60 here, so it's obviously not his first time. If, you know, I was thinking about this. If they really wanted to keep four members of the Social Outcasts, I guess the easy thing to do would be to take Victor and just shove him in there. But, and I said this on Twitter, how poetic would it be for them to add Josh from Tough Enough, who I guess they don't call him Josh. I guess his name down there in developmental is Bronson Pinchot, whatever the fuck his name is. Fucking Balky. Take Josh from Tough Enough and put him in the Social Outcasts. You know, he didn't exactly endear himself to the other wrestlers when he made that jobber comment a few months ago. I'm sure they would treat him very well. We lost another ECW original this past week. Balls Mahoney passed away on Tuesday, just one day after celebrating his 44th birthday. This after Axel Rotten passed away in February, also at 44 years old, which is kind of eerie. You know, the two of them were tag team partners for a while. I actually got an email forwarded to me from a close family friend. Her husband apparently was related by marriage to Balls Mahoney. And I never even knew that. I had no idea. I guess it never would have. There never would have been a reason for that to come up in any conversations. We don't see them that often. But it's just wild. I never knew that. And he even showed up to their grandson's bar mitzvah, which is wild to think about. Balls Mahoney at a bar mitzvah, just kind of chilling out, acting all normal. They didn't know the cause of death. Nobody knows at this point. She did say what they think it was. I don't know if she meant what she herself thinks or what the family thinks, because they've spoken to Balls' wife and his family. I don't want to say. We'll just wait and see what the coroner has to say. His wife, Gail, did speak to Pro Wrestling Sheet, said they were watching Jeopardy together and answering trivia questions before he just suddenly went unconscious. She did say that he fell the week before. He was having trouble getting around. I think he hurt his hip. She has no idea if one thing led to the other. There's just no way of knowing at this point. He wrestled for Smoky Mountain and WWE before going to ECW. I remember the story from Chris Jericho's first book back in the Smoky Mountain days when he lived with Balls. He actually lived in an apartment with him. And it's just such a disgusting story. He finds a nest full of roaches living under his mattress. Because I think him and some other guy were actually going into Balls' room to clean up because Balls never cleaned after himself. And they discover this nest of just dozens and dozens of cockroaches living under the guy's mattress, because I guess he would eat and he would take the scraps and just shove them underneath instead of, you know, throwing them away. So this guy was practically living in squalor in his room, and that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back for Jericho, as it would be, I think, for anybody. And that was the last time that he ever lived with Balls Mahoney, but that was his introduction to him. In WWE, of course, they gave him the Wrestle Craptacular Santa Claus gimmick, where he played Santa's evil brother from the South Pole. Yes, this was a real thing. He attacked Savio Vega at an In Your House pay-per-view as he was handing out presents to the fans, and he didn't last very long. They got rid of him after, I think he fell asleep backstage at a TV taping. It might have been his first TV taping, and that was the end of him. So from there, he ends up, and by the way, before I even go on, we've been through this before, but Vince McMahon was on a mega acid trip in 1995. When you look at, you know, the plumber, the garbage man, the evil dentist, and evil Santa Claus, you had Dean Douglas, the evil school teacher. It's like, you know, the economy must have been in real rough shape that year for all these people to have to go out and moonlight as pro wrestlers. So anyway, he ends up in ECW. And in ECW, he became very well known for swinging a steel chair. Also became very well known for taking a lot of unprotected chair shots to the head. But, you know, a lot of those ECW guys took unprotected chair shots. You know, how a guy like a Masato Tanaka, I think of him. I think of that first one-night stand pay-per-view when they brought him in, and he and Mike Awesome, they tore the house down. Mike Awesome also literally tore his knee out, so it was more than just tearing the house down. But those two guys went out there, and they beat the fuck out of each other. And it was entertaining as all hell. They had a great match. But that was in 2005. Okay, Masato Tanaka was taking unprotected chair shots and all kinds of abuse years earlier, like in the original ECW. And I'm sure in Japan as well. So this was in 05. They bring him back. He steals the show. And now, here we are 11 years later, and to my knowledge, he's still out there wrestling. I mean, I don't know if he's wrestling full-time or not, but he's over in Japan. He's still going at it, and he seems to be okay. How a guy like a Masato Tanaka can even function today is a miracle of modern science. Two things I did not know about Balls Mahoney before this past week and reading some of the nice write-ups that people have put together on him. I didn't know that he wrestled in high school and was banned for headbutting a referee. That's kind of cool. And I didn't know that when he initially came to ECW, he played a gay biker character. I did not know that. But ECW gave him a career as Balls Mahoney. It made him who he was. Paul Heyman gave him a shot that I'm sure he probably would not have gotten anywhere else. And he made the most of it. And he was never a top guy, but he garnered this cult following and he became a star. And when ECW went under, he took it real hard. He was one of the guys that really took it hard to the point where he tried to commit suicide. WWE brought him in for that first one-night stand pay-per-view. They brought him back for the ECW revival the following year. He does have a match on his resume with John Cena. Not too many people can say that. And he even did a Beauty and the Beast type storyline with Kelly Kelly. I think they dated for a while. If you saw what Balls looked like in recent years, if you saw some of the shoot interviews, if you saw any photos of him, you would never in a million years guess that this was a 44-year-old man. You know, 64 maybe, but not 44. He looked like a senior citizen. You know, he was missing most of his teeth. I don't know if that was from the drug use or I read also where... Yeah, he would use Fireball sometimes in his matches, and so he would put this chemical, he would keep it in his mouth so he could ignite the Fireball, and you know, you do that over time, that's going to rot your teeth out. So that may have had more to do with that, but he had no teeth, practically. Got real skinny because he could hardly eat anything, because that's hard to do when you have no teeth. The lifestyle he lived, the drugs, it's well documented, he admitted to it. It took its toll. Obviously took its toll. And one of the more disgusting things that I've seen, and I'm sure some of you have as well, is the video on YouTube of the match he had a few years ago with Marty Jannetty. He takes a chair shot to the back of the head, and he proceeds to stop the match, ducks his head through the ropes, and pukes outside the ring. And whether it was from the chair shot or if he was on something at the time, which would not be all that surprising, who knows? I can only imagine how many concussions that guy must have suffered throughout his career. It's mind-boggling. But what makes this so sad is, you know, by all accounts, the people who knew him, the people who worked with him even just once, the people who maybe didn't know him so well, but they knew of him, they interacted with him, across the board, he was legitimately one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And, you know, he didn't go out of his way to treat other people like shit. He wasn't a dick. He wasn't an asshole. He didn't try to fuck people over. He was the genuine article. And by all accounts, despite all of his flaws and the drug use and everything else, he was a nice guy. And, you know, nice or not, 44 is too young to die. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And unfortunately, he's not the first of that old ECW crew to pass away early. And unfortunately, he won't be the last. Because that's, you know, they lived a lot of very hard lifestyles, and eventually that catches up to you. You know, whatever happened here, I'm sure what he put his body through over the years did not do him any favors. And it's a really shitty, sad situation to see something like that happen to a guy who, by all accounts, seems like a nice guy. And so I just wanted to say a few things there about Balls Mahoney. I saw Tommy Dreamer did a really nice, really classy tribute to Balls at his House of Hardcore show last night. Somebody uploaded video of it on YouTube. If it's still up, if you find it, you should check it out. It's pretty cool stuff. He didn't do a 10-bell salute. He said Balls wouldn't want that. It was actually, it was really sad because he was describing, I guess, a tribute they had done for Axel Rotten a couple months ago, and I guess Balls was there. And Tommy Dreamer was talking about how the whole time Balls, he was calling him by his real name, John. He was like, John was just like, oh, I can't believe this. This sucks, man. This sucks. Like, what had happened to Axel, who he was very close with. And so here we are now 2 months later, and Balls is dead. And Tommy Dreamer says, in lieu of doing a 10-bell salute, which is not something Balls would have wanted, we're gonna give Balls Mahoney a more proper tribute. And they started playing the AC/DC song, which, of course, was Balls' theme music. So I thought that was a really nice thing that Dreamer did. Bray Wyatt had his own Kevin Nash moment on the WWE European Tour last Wednesday. Nash, if you remember, he took a step and tore his quad. Well, Bray went in for a lockup with Roman Reigns right at the beginning of their match, and he suffered some sort of calf injury. Bad enough that the match had to be stopped. He was helped to the back. He was then taken off the remainder of the tour. There has been no update at all from WWE since the initial one. They did acknowledge the fact that he suffered a calf injury. They have not updated that story since, so we don't know if it's a serious injury that's going to require surgery, if he tore something, if he's going to be out for months, if it's something where he'll be back in a couple of weeks. Maybe it's not that serious. We don't know. They can ill afford another injury to a top or near the top guy. So the timing of this is absolutely horrendous, because they obviously had some kind of plan going forward for Bray and the Wyatts. It looked like maybe they were turning a babyface, possibly. He had a big night on Raw last Monday, which we're going to talk about here in a second. So really shitty timing, but we just don't know any more than that at this point. So hopefully it's nothing too serious and he'll be back. You know, even if he has to be out for a month or something, you can have him on TV. If he's mobile, he can still show up and cut promos and stuff and then not be out for that long. If this is something where he's got to be out, you know, 3 months, 6 months, it's just devastating. And devastating for him, I'm sure. Nobody's more frustrated than him. I mean, he's had back issues recently, now this. So, and it's one of those things where you say to yourself, man, these guys are so overworked. And they are. I think the entire roster is overworked. I know why they run all the shows they do, because they want to make money. But there's an argument to be made that these guys are being worked a little too much. And when you have so many guys down, so many guys hurt, maybe you got to pull back a little bit or start rotating guys out. I mean, in this case, this was a freak injury. I mean, this was literally on a lockup. He stepped forward and fucked up his calf. But that, again, it's the sign of something larger, I think, that potentially is going on when you have freak injuries occurring like this. And freak injuries are always going to occur no matter what. But part of it also, I think, is the fact that when you're on the road so often, yeah, look, that's wear and tear on your body. And so I think, again, if you could pull back on that, if you could find a way to pull back on that a little bit, I don't know if that means bringing up more NXT guys or maybe just not running as many shows. You're sacrificing some money. Yeah, you are. But in the grand scheme of things, maybe if you don't lose a guy like a John Cena or a Seth Rollins, if it somehow curtails some of those injuries from happening, you're probably better off for it. Because you can make a hell of a lot more money with those guys around instead of them sitting on the sidelines for 6 months or 9 months. Raw this past Monday was live from Los Angeles. Raw Instapoll that I threw up on Twitter after the show, almost 2,000 of you voted. 86% thumbs up, 14% thumbs down. Second week in a row that you have given Raw not just a thumbs up, but a resounding thumbs up. And I agree. I thought this show was even better than the post-WrestleMania show. We had one great match. We had one really good match. And the Bullet Club finally debuted. And they're not going to be called that, but until they get a new name, that's what we'll call them. They took out the Usos after their win over the Social Outcasts in the tag team tournament to determine a new number one contender for the tag team titles to wrestle a New Day. They beat them up. They laid him out with their magic killer finish, which Michael Cole referred to by that name. But when I rewatched the clip, WWE put the clip up on their Twitter page. I don't know if it's like this on their YouTube page or not, but when I went back and I watched it, they edited out the magic killer mention. So I would not be so quick to assume they're letting them keep that name. Yeah, there's a reason AJ Styles uses the calf crusher now and not the calf killer. So it looks like this might be changed also. I thought it was a good way to debut them. Not a great way to debut them. A great way to debut them would have been to involve them in some way in the Payback main event. They still might. they could still do that. I hope they do. You know, maybe they just wanted to establish them first on TV to the mainstream audience for a few weeks. It is interesting that they took out the Usos, who are, of course, the cousins of Roman Reigns. You know, the announcers made it a point to ask the question, why the Usos? You know, why are they attacking the Usos? It almost makes you think that they did it for AJ, right? That's what they want you to think. Or at least, without saying it, kind of like a wink to the inside fans, so to speak, that wanting you to think that they were acting on behalf of AJ Styles, and maybe they'll help Styles at the pay-per-view. They could still do the swerve, and I'm hoping they do. I still like the idea that I pitched of the two of them helping Roman Reigns and forming the Roman Empire. We'll see what they do. Speaking of the tag team tournament, I have the brackets here in front of me. It's quite a colorful graphic, the way they did this with the New Day rainbows. The Usos and the Social Outcasts, Golden Truth against the Vaudevillains, Enzo and Kaz against the Ascension, and the Lucha Dragons against the Dudley Boys. So the Dudley Boys are in the semifinals. They bested the Lucha Dragons. Usos also advanced Vaudevillains, Enzo and Kaz, so they've all moved on. Here's how I would do this. Here's how I would do this tag team tournament. I would play it like the Usos are hurt. Okay, they were taken out by Gallows and Anderson last week. Maybe one of them is injured, so they forfeit their spot in the tournament. Shane McMahon, very impressed by the initiative that these two guys showed. He allows Gallows and Anderson to prove their mettle. He puts them in the tournament. They take the Usos' spot. You hold the two semifinal matches on Raw this week. Okay, you have Gallows and Anderson kill the Vaudevillains, which they absolutely should do. Enzo and Kaz beat the Dudley Boys. The next week, that's the go-home Raw to the pay-per-view, you have the finals. Gallows and Anderson against Enzo and Kaz. The Dudleys interfere. They cost Enzo and Kaz the match. That can lead to a rematch between those two teams at Payback, so that's a new match. And meanwhile, Gallows and Anderson, they get the tag team title match against the New Day at the pay-per-view. I would do it at the pay-per-view. I don't know if that's their plan or if they're going to do the finals of this tournament at the pay-per-view and save the title match for some other time. I would have the New Day defend at the pay-per-view and lose the tag team titles to Anderson and Gallows. Anderson and Gallows then come back out during the main event. They tease helping AJ Styles. Ultimately, they help Roman, and the Roman Empire is formed. And then when the Usos come back, you can have them confront Roman about, you know, why would you align with the two guys who put us out? Like, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, Us? Right? Isn't that what they call everybody, Us? So Gallows and Anderson beat him down again. You can do a little program with the two of them for the tag team titles after that. And don't forget, they've also got the New Day, right, who get their rematch. So they've already got a couple of different teams lined up for them to wrestle. But these are minor details. The key is these guys can be used, I think, as more than just another tag team. Putting the belts on them and then involving them in that main event and aligning them with the champion, I think that establishes them as players, which is what this company needs more of. That's why I kind of laughed last week when I said there were people who didn't like the idea strictly because we don't want them associated with Roman Reigns. It's like, Roman Reigns is the champion. You don't have to like the guy, whether you like him or not. He's the guy. He's the champion. And so associating with him, I guess on the one hand, you could say, well, it's toxic. The only way I would associate Gallows and Anderson with Roman Reigns is if Roman Reigns goes heel. And if Roman Reigns goes heel, I think that solves a lot of the problems that he's having right now. I'm not advocating keeping Roman Reigns exactly as he is and putting these two with him because, yes, I do think it would be toxic. I think Dean Ambrose is maybe the only guy who's kind of shielded, no pun intended, shielded from that. People still love him, even though him and Roman are still, you know, best friends. But only if they go forward with the Reigns turn would I move forward with this whole Roman Empire idea. So by associating them with Roman, the guy's the champion. How is that a bad thing? You know, you don't have to like the idea, but to not like it for that reason is just stupid to me. But I think this would establish Gallows and Anderson as more than just a team. You know, they are players. They are upper card guys already on that roster, and they need as many of those kind of guys as they can get. So that's why I think that idea makes a lot of sense. Shane McMahon was back running Raw for the second straight week due to what they called overwhelming social media support. Apparently, they're very selective in the types of social media that they are influenced by. I find it ironic that the stipulation going into WrestleMania was that if The Undertaker loses, Shane McMahon gets Raw, and The Undertaker, for all intents and purposes, has to retire, right? He can never again compete at WrestleMania. If he can't wrestle at WrestleMania, there's no point really in The Undertaker wrestling. And so Undertaker beats Shane, just straight up beats him, and Shane is running Raw while it looks like Undertaker may have wrestled his last WrestleMania match. It's just like, I mean, that's what he was telling people apparently backstage at the show, that the match with Shane would be his last Mania match. I call bullshit. I mean, I still think he's wrestling in Orlando next year. I still think they probably want to get that John Cena match. I can't see this being his last match. I just don't buy it. I think if Cena was healthy and they did the Cena-Undertaker match at Texas Stadium this year, that would have been his last match. But I don't think Shane McMahon will go down as The Undertaker's final ever opponent. But it sure does look like he thinks he's done, which begs the question, why not just do the finish where Undertaker beats the crap out of Shane and Shane does his big dive and Undertaker kind of takes pity on the guy and looks at the bigger picture, and everybody knows that this is a match he would win anyway, and so he pulls Shane on top of him. He sacrifices himself to rid us of the Authority, who also have been gone the last couple of weeks. Why ask why? I guess, right? Why ask why? Shane did give an excellent match to us between Kevin Owens and Cesaro to open up the show. 15 minutes this went. Cesaro won clean with the neutralizer in the middle to become the new number one contender to the Intercontinental title. Cesaro not only looks like James Bond now when he walks out, although I would say he reminds me more of the Transporter than he does James Bond, but they've given him the Bond entrance. How freaking cool was that when he walked out? He walked out across the stage, and in the background on the screen, they've now incorporated the classic James Bond eye intro thingy, the crosshairs. Right? Actually, I like my name for it better, the James Bond intro thingy. That's the technical name for it, I guess. I thought that was the coolest thing. I'm a big Bond fan. Roger Moore, still the best Bond. Sorry, Brad. There was a lot of great wrestling, actually, on this show. Shane also gave us an AJ Styles-Sami Zayn match. I mean, this fucking guy, he's a regular Gabe Sapolsky now, only with much nicer sneakers. Zayn hit a beautiful Blue Thunderbomb during this match. I fucking love that move. He never wins with it, but the fans are always into it for a near fall. It's like that Sidewinder move that Matt Hardy used to do. I don't ever remember him. I'm not saying he didn't, but I don't ever remember him winning with that move. But I'll be damned if those fans didn't go fucking nuts for it every time he hit that move, and then they couldn't believe it when the other guy would kick out. You know, there was a scary moment here, though, toward the end, where Sami Zayn, he countered, I think it was a top rope power bomb attempt by Styles, like a sunset flip power bomb, and Sami was trying to flip back, I guess, onto his feet. He landed right on the top of his head. But when I watched it back, he got his hands down, and really he landed more on his hands than his head. I'm not saying his head didn't make contact with the mat, but he did land more on his hands. But it was damn scary when that happened. He missed the Huluva kick in the corner. He got caught with the phenomenal forearm and pinned. So AJ Styles looked strong going into his championship match of Payback, and Sami Zayn lost absolutely nothing here. He gained a lot more than he lost. In fact, backstage after the match, Shane McMahon ran up to both of them just gushing about what a great match this was, and this is exactly what I had in mind when I talked about changing Raw. So this was a big endorsement for both AJ Styles and for Sami Zayn. For the hat trick, we got a third really good match on this show. This one was for the women's title, with Charlotte defending against Natty. Natty had the match won with the sharpshooter when Ric Flair pulled the referee out of the ring, got his daughter DQ'd. Fans were just dying to see her take the title from her, and that's what made this finish so great. You know, it perfectly sets up the rematch between them. I'm sure that they'll have it Payback. Dr. Phil was out there. He had absolutely no reason to be, but there he was. He was sitting at ringside, and he talked about being disappointed that Charlotte had to once again resort to cheating as a way to keep her championship. There was a woo-off of sorts backstage. They did a skit earlier with Dr. Phil and Ric Flair, and Dr. Phil completely out-wooed Ric Flair, which was kind of weird. That was mildly entertaining, but still, there was no reason for this guy to be on the show. And you know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, 10 years ago, this would have been a mixed tag at the next pay-per-view. It would have been Charlotte and Ric Flair against Natty and Dr. Phil. So remember, it could always be worse. No matter how bad you think things are, it could always be worse. By the way, I got around to watching the match that Paige and Emma had on Main Event a couple weeks back. I can't tell you the last time I watched anything from Main Event, but I watched this match. It's worth tracking down. I don't think it was as good as this match here with Charlotte and Natty. It might have been longer, but longer doesn't necessarily mean better. It's a good match. They gave them a lot of time. Paige won with the Rampage. Then last weekend, I think it was actually a week ago today, Paige did one of those Q&As at Wizard World. She does these a lot. And she had some very interesting things to say. She admitted she has no idea what was going on or what is going on with her character. She has no idea if she's supposed to be a heel or a face. And she thinks that Roman Reigns should be a heel champion. And she admitted that sometimes the fans just get tired of certain guys getting shoved down their throats. And perhaps not coincidentally, Paige had another match with Emma, this time on SmackDown a couple days later, and she was beaten in 3 minutes. So make of that what you will. We got another Puerto Rico vignette with Primo and Epico smelling flowers. Where's Carol from The Walking Dead when you need her? I said this on Twitter. They need to bring in Carlito with these guys and make them a trio, because without him, these guys are going to be DOA within a month. You know, this is the second or third time now that they've repackaged them. And they're very talented, and they deserve another shot. But it's still their second or third time repackaging these guys. They're not going to do any more with them now than they did before when they had the Bull. At least when they had the Bull, I'm sure Vince was like, this is great, let's get them on TV. Now they got nothing. They got fucking flowers. If they don't bring Carlito in, then it's all over. You know, at least with Carlito, they have a shot, and they can challenge New Day in trios matches. So hopefully they will bring him in, he'll be part of this act, and believe me, they'll have more success that way. They did a highlight reel segment with Jericho coming out to interview himself. Dean Ambrose came out. He rechristened it the Ambrose Asylum. He laid out Jericho with the dirty deeds. So this was supposedly going to be a match at WrestleMania going back many months. That had been the plan, and that morphed many times. And we see what we ended up getting, which I think was probably better. I mean, having Ambrose and Lesnar, which I thought was disappointing, but as a match, and then Jericho and AJ, I thought that was probably the better idea. But now they're going back to the original plan, and so that'll be a match at the Payback pay-per-view, which is fine. Yeah, I'm sure they'll have a good match. I didn't think much of the segment. In fact, I thought it sucked, but I think the match will be good. Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt teamed up against Sheamus and Alberto Del Rio in the main event. Anyone but you, Roman, except tonight. Did I not just pitch the idea of a babyface Bray against a heel Roman Reigns and how much of a money feud that can be? We got a taste of babyface Bray here, and it worked. People were very into him, hell of a lot more than they were into Reigns. Wyatt got the hot tag, which may have been the first time I've ever seen him get the hot tag in a match before. The fans were going nuts for this guy. The finish was really cool. Bray hits the Sister Abigail on Del Rio. And as he covers him for the pin, he notices Sheamus is coming into the ring. And Bray just reaches up and points at him. Like he's pointing at Sheamus, as if to say, like, get him, Roman. And Reigns comes from out of nowhere for the spear. I thought that was a nice little touch there from Bray. Very appropriate also for Bray Wyatt to get the win in the main event of a show that was dedicated to the memory of his grandfather, Blackjack Mulligan. And now he's hurt. On a collar and elbow tie-up. Now he's hurt. It's unreal. If you gave up on the Edge and Christian show after the first episode, which I know a lot of you did, and I was very tempted to do because it was not very good, or if you've never watched the show before, you need to give it another shot. It's great. It's become my weekly guilty pleasure. Some of my favorite lines from this last episode, they're harassing Paul Heyman. And you gotta understand, this is a very scattershot show. It's not like there's one... each show kind of has a theme, but there's not like one storyline. It's just a bunch of different skits with a bunch of different people. And on this one, they had Paul Heyman. They're harassing him about who cut off his ponytail. And Heyman insists, well, I did. But they're like, oh, we don't believe you. and they promise to investigate. And Heyman's talking, and when he's done talking, he says, "Oh, I feel like a giant weight has been lifted off my shoulders." And Christian's writing all this down on his pad like a gumshoe, and he just goes, "Okay, Tommy Dreamer has just been lifted off your shoulders. Got it." And I fucking died. Then later, Pete Gass, of all people, he plays a mailman, and he delivers a box of chocolates to them. And Christian takes a bite out of one of the chocolates. He's like, "Ooh, this chocolate, it's so strong and powerful. It's probably the strongest chocolate in the entire box. So strong, it should have its own section." And the flavor is so intense. He goes, "It's gaining momentum. It's about to break through." Oh, it's gone. Like someone pulled the rug out from underneath it. And then he looks at the box and he's like, "It's Swiss Cesaro flavor." And what else happened here? I know I'm spoiling the entire thing. They show clips from YouTube of two fans that do reaction videos. And they show their reactions to AJ Styles debuting at the Royal Rumble. These guys are two of the biggest AJ Styles fans in the world. And they have just a complete meltdown when this guy walks out. So they invited the fans to be on their show to watch some AJ Styles impersonators, kind of judge them to see who is most like AJ. And one of them has the mannerisms down pat, right? The last one. He pulls the hood off, and it turns out to be AJ himself. And their reactions are just priceless. They also interrogate Brutus the Barber Beefcake about Paul Heyman's missing ponytail. And what else happened here? Bayley came and she canes the shit out of Tommy Dreamer with a kendo stick. I mean, the show is so random, it's great. And the next episode that they showed previews for, it has Virgil, Mean Gene Okerlund, and Sean Mooney. And I'm telling you, it's only 25 minutes. It's more entertaining than most Raws. It's great. I would give it a shot. Because I was not enamored with that initial couple of episodes that they did, but I've stuck with it, and it has greatly improved over time. I do think you'll enjoy it more if you're a longtime fan. Otherwise, you probably won't get a lot of the references and the little inside jokes. Speaking of the network, one last thing here. They have started adding, or they will be adding, SmackDown episodes from the year 2000, and I think 2001 as well. I think 2002 and 2003 were probably SmackDown's best years. 2000, though, it's not far behind. A lot of quality stuff there. Those are definitely worth checking out once they go up. I know they have some up, but I think they're in the process of adding all of them the entire year. They've also added all of the Raw episodes from Triple H's Reign of Terror, which I plan to avoid. It just brings back horrible flashbacks.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT, this was the first of several shows they taped from WrestleMania Access in Dallas. Austin Aries made his NXT TV debut here against Angelo Dawkins. Dawkins is still doing that annoying mixing gesture with his hands when he comes out. You know, if you pulled that shit 20 years ago in this company, Vince would have given him a Baker gimmick, since everyone worked two jobs on that roster back then. You know, like fucking Angelo Cookie Dough Dawkins would be his name. I shall refer to him as The Baker from now on, if he insists on doing that. At least until I forget. It's very possible I will just forget about this in a week. Yeah, I want you to know, I spent a good, I'd say, 2 or 3 minutes, like legit 2 or 3 minutes, on the phone at work the other day. I was on, like, with some automated system. I was, you know, you have to press 1 for this, press 6 for that, you know, press 8 to go fuck yourself. So I'm on the phone with this system. I get the automated message, and I'm trying to press 1, and nothing's happening. And I'm getting more and more pissed off. I'm like, why is this not working? It's not even registering. Until I realize I was pushing the 1 key on my computer keyboard and not on my phone. I need to start getting more than 4 hours of sleep a night. Noah can vouch. I don't sleep. Anyway, Austin Aries won with the discus forearm. He knocked out the Baker and got the pin. Next week, Samoa Joe says that he is going to make an example out of Apollo Crews. How about this? Joe and Nakamura had their first ever match. I think it was their first ever match anywhere at the NXT House Show in Orlando Friday night. And by all accounts, they tore it up. Nakamura won with the Bomaye, which has been renamed the Kinshasa, because apparently there is a clothing company that has the Beaumier name trademarked. I'm hoping this is an early dry run for a match between these two at the next TakeOver special. They did announce the next live special at Full Sail takes place on Wednesday, June 8th. And to me, that's a main event right there. Now imagine for a moment if Joe had won the championship from Finn Balor in Dallas, and they brought Finn up on Raw that Monday to debut the Balor Club with Gallows and Anderson, and Joe drops the title to Nakamura at the next live special. And then Joe gets called up to the main roster. Nakamura now could have himself a nice little run with the title, carrying NXT on his shoulders. You know, maybe he could feud with Hideo Itami. You know, Itami might be ready to come back by that point. Although I don't know who would cut the promos in that feud. You know, you need to have at least one guy who could do the talking. But then again, let's be honest here. It's not like Finn Balor is a great promo. So I think you can get by. You can get by. If you've got the charisma and the personality and you're a good wrestler, you can do fine. You don't necessarily need to go out there and hit home runs in the promo department, at least not in NXT. But anyway, they didn't do that. Balor retained, and I don't know. I mean, what? Balor and Aries maybe for the championship at the next live special? I mean, that'd be a hell of a double main event right there. You had Joe against Nakamura and Aries against Balor for the championship. And the Drifter against Alex Riley in a loser-leaves NXT match where they both get counted out. We got to see the NXT debut of Tessa Blanchard, daughter of WWE Hall of Famer Tully Blanchard, who I had the privilege of interviewing right here on this very podcast a few years back with Arn Anderson, episode 212. One of the many interviews we did on that episode. That's still, to me, one of the highlights in doing this show. Is being able to interview two of the Four Horsemen together the day before Dusty Rhodes inducted them into the Hall of Fame. How cool is that? How often do you see Arn and Tully even together these days? Not very often. I don't think she's actually signed to NXT. This may have been more of a tryout than anything. Or, you know, sometimes they'll bring people in, they do the job, and they still go out and wrestle on the indies. She lost to Alexa Bliss, who was pretty awesome in this match. There was one spot where she grabbed Tessa by the throat for what looked like a chokeslam, but instead she kind of threw her back down on the mat. She should have chokeslammed her. You know, the visual of this tiny woman chokeslamming people, it'd be like when Hurricane was going around chokeslamming people, only Hurricane never looked as good as Alexa Bliss does. So Alexa won with the backflip into the double knees to the gut. Finn Balor was interviewed backstage. He recited a crappy promo while looking off camera at someone or something. Cue cards, maybe. Look in the fucking camera. Okay, please, for the love of God, let this guy look into the camera. Thank you. Tommaso Ciampa and Johnny Gargano beat the Vaudevillains, who are in the WWE Tag Team Title Tournament on Raw and SmackDown. So this shocked the hell out of me. I know the whole, you know, doing the honors on the way out thing, and you know, they did it with Sami Zayn at TakeOver, but still, I was very surprised by this result. And that also that it was Simon Gotch tapping out to the armbar by Ciampa. This was no fluke win. This was a decisive submission victory. Baron Corbin made short work of Tucker Knight. It was hilarious listening to Corey Graves on commentary chastising the ring announcer for failing to mention Baron Corbin's big win in the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal when he got introduced here, especially given that this would have been taped the day before WrestleMania. So I just thought that was funny. Besides Joe and Cruz next week, it's going to be Colin Cassidy and Enzo Amore against American Alpha in a non-title match. Bayley made her first appearance here since losing the women's title to Asuka, and she was beloved by this crowd. She beat Liv Tyler with the belly to Bayley. Liv Tyler is somebody to watch out for. She is insanely beautiful. I will not hold the jersey thing against her. And also, she's getting better. You know, she pulled off an impressive head scissors tilt-a-whirl move here during this match. You know, if she keeps improving, I think she could be a real player in the women's division here. I have a thing for blondes, you know, what can I say? Got Alexa and Maryse and Lana, of course. And yet, oddly enough, I've dated three redheads before, so go figure. After the match, Bayley cut this great little babyface promo about how the test of a true champion is how they get back up after they've been knocked down. Really cliche stuff, but this, I mean, they love this woman so much, they just ate it up. She hugged Izzy after the match. You know, we forgot to mention that on the WrestleMania Roundtable show that we had a whole conversation with Izzy and her parents at WrestleMania. We were going to our seats, or we were looking for them in the seats, that is, and they were just sitting there. They were right there, and Noah was having a whole conversation with Izzy's mom, and I walked over and got introduced to them, and I was talking to Izzy. I asked her if this was her first WrestleMania, and she said it was, and she was all excited. It's a nice family. It's a nice family. I feel bad now for laughing when Sasha Banks made her cry. I'm just kidding. That's still one of my favorite moments from last year. A heel being a heel. We don't get to see that very often these days. It's a beautiful thing. Main event was Ty Dillinger against Shinsuke Nakamura in his NXT television debut. He was greeted as a total megastar. Dillinger said he's a perfect 10, and the fans chanted he's 11 in reference to Nakamura. Nakamura won with the Kinshasa. This guy could go to the main roster right now and challenge for the world title and not look out of place. He carries himself like a star. And I really do. As fun as it is to see him in NXT, and I do think you could put the title on him and give him a little run. And Joe deserves to be, you know, he deserves a spot on the main roster because he's put the time in and he's doing some of his best work right now. But I don't want to see Nakamura down in NXT for too long because I do think that he can contribute a lot to the main roster. And I'd like to think that they're paying him probably a decent amount of money. And even somebody like Vince McMahon can see what they have in this guy and that they can make money with him and not just put him in there as the fourth fucking social outcast, you know. I do worry about that, but I want to see this guy doing big things on the main roster soon. So this was fun. And Dillinger deserves credit, too, because there were a lot of fun interactions here in this match. A little silly, but not too much. And it was a good showing for Nakamura. So that was NXT. Fun show. Let's talk TNA. Speaking of silly, PW Insider broke the news that TNA is moving its corporate headquarters very soon out of their longtime offices in Nashville to the warehouse that houses all of its merchandise. And I think it was Dave Meltzer who said that what happened is they fell behind in their rent, and so they are essentially being forced out, which makes sense. I mean, they've been in that location apparently for years and years and years. Dixie Carter ran a PR company before she hooked up with TNA called Trifecta Entertainment. They had been located in that same office. So Dixie in that office goes back probably well over a decade. Maybe even closer to two. So something must have happened for them to suddenly be moving. And let's be honest here. Would it be all that shocking if it was true that TNA, you know, we learned that they fell behind in their rent payments? I think we've heard this before. They also lost something else. They lost their Tuesday night replay for Impact. I guess they're leaving it behind at the old office. According to James Caldwell over at The Torch, it had to do with ad revenue and the fact that TNA is hardly bringing any in. Shocking, I know. They got a hold of some ad sales information over there at The Torch to prove the point. The first run airing of Impact on, I think it was March 29th is what they have listed here, brought in $18,000 in ad revenue. Okay, Days of Our Lives, which was the lead-in to Impact, brought in $44,000 in ad revenue. Now, the average cost for a 30-second ad spot during Impact, $335. The average cost for a 30-second ad spot during Days of Our Lives, somewhere between $1,100 and $1,250. So that tells the story right there, why Pop TV made that move. They've moved the replay to Saturday mornings, I guess, to see if it can maybe gain some traction over there. I mean, this sounds a lot like what happened with Destination America toward the end. And again, we all know how that ended. By all accounts, they're still talking to potential buyers and potential investors. Dixie is still hesitant to give up 51% control of the company, which would give control to whoever the new buyer is. And this woman is bound and determined to hold on to this company the way that she held on to Hulk Hogan's leg on Impact. So that's the update on TNA. There isn't really too much good going on. I mean, from what I hear, the shows are pretty good. But at this point, they're just, it's like a hamster on the wheel. You know, they're kind of just moving in one spot. And each week, it just seems like there's something else. There's just something else that always happens with this company. And right now, it's not looking too good. Ring of Honor, I'm glad I was able to check out Ring of Honor this past week. Kenny Omega had a great match with ACH. But the main event is something that's worth going out of your way to see. At least as of yesterday, it was still up on the Ring of Honor website. They have it where you can watch the previous week's episode on there. That's where I watched it. Dalton Castle and Silas Young in a fight without honor, which they said was the first time they ever had a fight without honor on their TV show. And basically a fight without honor, it's a grudge match, no holds barred, you know, pinfall or submission only. These guys, they had a war in that ring, and there was a really scary spot toward the end where Dalton Castle had him up in position. He was trying to go for his bangarang finish, and Silas Young grabbed the top rope, and he wouldn't let go. So you have to picture this. If you know the move, then you're familiar with it. If you're not familiar with what the move is, he basically, think about Hardcore Holly's old Alabama Slam, or what they called it for 1 week on Raw, the Hollycost, fucking morons. That's kind of how he sets up people for the move, and then he kind of spins them around and slams them down. So he's got Dalton Castle, or he's got Silas Young's legs basically on his shoulders. And Silas is holding onto that top rope. Now, I had forgotten that there was a table, or I think two tables set up outside the ring on that side. So he's trying, he can't hit the move, and so he just flings Silas Young up for a back body drop, and Silas Young, he overshot the tables. He was supposed to go through the tables. Instead, his head basically hit the tables, and the tables broke, but it was a brutal, brutal looking bump. I don't know how he didn't break his back or concuss himself. Maybe he did, who the hell knows. But that was a brutal spot, and in the end, he did hit the bangarang, he got the pin, and it seemed like a blow-off. And if it was, that's the way a blow-off should be. It comes down to these two guys going in there in a street fight, and they're throwing in everything but the kitchen sink, beating the hell out of each other, and in the end, one guy wins decisively, and that's it. And as much as I've enjoyed the Silas Young Dalton Castle stuff, I think this thing has run its course. It's time for both of them to move on. I still think that Dalton Castle would make a good challenger for Jay Lethal's championship sometime in the next few months. I hope that's the direction that they go in, but this was a hell of a match. And like I said, if you didn't see it, if you don't have Ring of Honor on TV in your area, neither do I, go on the website, you can watch it there, it's a hell of a match. Lucha Underground this past week. I love the opening scene in Dario Cueto's office where he tells Johnny Mundo and Taya, and they call him Cage, that he's pairing the three of them up in the Trios tournament. And Cage, instead, he doesn't like that idea. He proposes a match between himself and Johnny Mundo. And Dario just goes, nope, I like my idea better. Which is like me when I see what WWE usually does on TV. And then on the sound off the following week, I've said that a time or two before. Cage, he doesn't like this, but he accepts it. And he goes all Roman Reigns on us here, and he tries to deliver his catchphrase, which he just says all the fucking time. He goes, I'm not a man, right? I'm not a man, I'm a machine. He goes, I'm not a man. And Dario just cuts him off and goes, I know, you're a machine. Just win the tournament. And Cage walks out, and Johnny Mundo mocks his stupid catchphrase once Cage is out of earshot. So anyway, they totally buried the catchphrase here, and I loved it. We had Killshot in the opening match against the returning Arjenis. I bet you didn't even realize that Arjenis was gone, because I sure didn't. Now that they've explained Killshot's military background, he comes to the ring in camo gear. He's wearing dog tags like he's John Cena. He wins the match with a Spike Michinoku driver. This was innovative. I can't say that I've seen the way he pulled this thing off. I haven't seen that before. Nice to see Killshot get a win for a change. We had Daga. Daga is the new addition to the Lucha Underground roster from AAA. He met with Dario Cueto in his office, and he was informed that he would be wrestling Tejano, with the winner receiving one of the 7 ancient Aztec medallions. Since we now need to crown a new Gift of the Gods champion, we're going to have these medallion matches now. And this was my first time seeing Daga, and you know I have not been impressed by Tejano since he debuted. He's not one of my favorites, but these two had a hell of a match. Hell of a match. Tejano won with the sit-out powerbomb to win the medallion. But it was very competitive, lots of back and forth. Daga looked real good in there. I figured Daga was losing because that's the pattern here on Lucha Underground. You know, most times when a new guy not named Matanza debuts, they lose in their first match. Same thing happened with PJ Black. Same thing happened with Jack Evans. I think he lost in his debut as well. That's just how they do things. Main event was Rey Mysterio, Prince Puma, and Dragon Azteca Jr. against Johnny Mundo, Taya, and they call him Cage in a Trios tournament match. This thing was balls-to-the-wall action from start to finish. This was so much fun. Things broke down toward the end between Mundo and Cage, as you would expect. They didn't get along very well, but there was a spot. Cage had Prince Puma up on his shoulders, so kind of like in position for an F5, if you want to visualize this. Dragon Azteca climbs to the top rope. He comes diving off at Cage, who has Puma on his shoulders. He dives off, and Cage catches him. So now he's got both guys, and then he drops him with a fallaway slam. That got a well-deserved holy shit chant out of the crowd and out of me, because that was a fucking impressive feat of strength right there. I don't care how small the... I know Prince Puma is not a big guy and Dragon Aztec is a skinny guy. So what? So what? That was impressive. And once Cage left, or he got knocked out of the ring or whatever happened, it was Mundo all by his lonesome. 619 by Rey Mysterio. Into a flying corkscrew DDT by Dragon Aztec. Rey then goes and does a seated dive off the apron onto Taya on the floor. Dragon Azteca follows that up with a springboard Hurricane Rana over the top rope and onto Cage on the floor, and he takes him over. And finally, in the ring, Prince Puma finishes Mundo off with the 630 for the win. Those last few minutes were insane. Insane! I needed a cigarette. I don't even smoke. Great match. Show ended with Dario Cueto talking to Matanza through the bars of his cell, and he's telling his brother, look, the reason I lock you away is because you're the most valuable thing in the world to me. And what do you do with your valuables? You lock them away so nobody can steal them from you. And he wants Matanza to bring death to Mil Muertes in their match next week. Matanza, I gotta say, I mean, he looks badass every week. He looked super badass here. He was all covered up. He was wearing some kind of mask, not the usual mask, where you could see his eyes and like nothing else. And with the eye showing through the mask, it reminded me a lot of Kane when he first debuted. And in case you forgot, there was in fact a time when Kane was badass. And my only hope is that 20 years from now, I'm not reviewing this show and talking about corporate Matanza, because I just don't think that would work. The one thing with Lucha Underground is, I don't think that that's something we need to worry about. So let's get to your questions in the mailbag. Please include your name and where you are from when you email thesolemonster@gmail.com. Curtis from Waterloo, Ontario wrote in expanding a little bit on an idea that I pitched last week for, you know, Shane McMahon and Triple H and kind of building some drama and dissension between the two of them. And I thought it was really good, so I wanted to mention it here. He says, you mentioned a Triple H and Shane feud on episode 435. What would you think of Seth Rollins returning to represent Shane and either Rollins taking on Triple H at SummerSlam or Rollins taking on someone of Triple H's choosing, perhaps Finn Balor or Samoa Joe? You could play off the hired henchman idea that you pitched for WrestleMania. You could use this as a way to rid the authority, or rid us of the authority, by making the stipulation that if Shane's representative wins, the authority is banished and Shane gets control of Raw. Well, I think this is all moot, unfortunately, because Shane has control of Raw, and we haven't seen the authority. So, I don't know that this really works now. But I love the idea, especially the Rollins part. I hadn't thought about that. You know, Rollins is due back in a few months. You could have both sides kind of playing the other to kind of get on Rollins' good side. And this is what could be used as a way to turn Rollins babyface and get that big match, maybe with Triple H at SummerSlam. Or Joe, right? I mean, I do still like the idea of Joe being Triple H's hired gun from NXT. But I hadn't even thought of getting Rollins involved in this, so I love that. Let's do an audio question. This one comes from Jake from the R&J Wrestling Podcast.
Hi, Solomonster. This is Jake from the R&J Wrestling Podcast. Considering how hot British wrestling is right now, it's a matter of time before a big indie star from Progress, Revolution Pro, or ICW makes it to the WWE. My question is, who do you see from these companies as being possibly the first ever British WWE champion? For me, it's either going to be Zack Sabre Jr. or Will Ospreay.
I'd probably go with Zack Sabre Jr. I think I'm with you on that. But I say that because I'm just not as familiar with everybody on the British wrestling scene. I've seen Zack Sabre Jr. only recently, and he's very impressive. I have seen Will Ospreay, but I don't see him as you know WWE champion. Zack Sabre Jr., you know, it'd have to be like a whole Daniel Bryan 2.0 situation with the fans getting behind him enough, because otherwise, I think it's going to be an uphill battle for the guy. I mean, look, they had Drew McIntyre, who looked the part. They had Wade Barrett. They have him only for a few more months. He looked the part, right? Two big European guys. One, I know one's not British, but both very tall, both very talented. Barrett, at least, is a great speaker. He can talk. I think McIntyre has gotten better. I can't say he was a great promo when he first came into WWE, but Barrett's been good from day one when it comes to his verbal skills, and he always had the size, and they still could not sniff the world title. So I think, you know, Sabre's got as good a shot as any, but it's not going to be easy. I don't want to say it'll never happen. I'm sure people said that about Daniel Bryan. But I think a guy like a Sami Zayn, and I think a guy like a Zack Sabre Jr., they've got that maybe that underdog thing going on. They're not the biggest, but they're really, really good. And all it takes is the fans to just unite behind a guy, and you never know. You know, sometimes that's all it takes, and eventually, you know, they'll get that shot. So I'd go with Sabre. Garrett from Washington, D.C., what matches would you want or do you think we'll see at this year's SummerSlam in Brooklyn? So I got this question from Garrett, and I was thinking in my head, like, I was trying to picture a card that I would like to see, but that I could see as being realistic. So, for example, I'm not a big fan of doing Brock Lesnar and Bray Wyatt, but I think we're going to get that match at some point, and it probably will be at SummerSlam. So I see a SummerSlam card that probably has Brock and Bray on there. I pitched Charlotte and Sasha Banks last week. I pitched a whole idea where they have a singles match at SummerSlam, and Sasha wins the championship, kind of redemption for that loss at NXT TakeOver in that same building a year ago, and then you bring in Bayley and you kind of build to a match between them at WrestleMania next year. So I think Charlotte and Sasha one-on-one for the championship in Brooklyn, that's probably going to be a match. I think AJ Styles against John Cena, I think, could be a match on that show, big match. And Roman Reigns defending the championship in the main event against Seth Rollins. I think that's how your SummerSlam card shapes out. Dion from Atlanta, Georgia, we are coming up on the 20th anniversary of Brian Pillman's death. And had he not died, what do you think the second half of his career would have been? And do you feel he should be in the WWE Hall of Fame? Also, which era was better to you, the summer of CM Punk in 2011 or the Brian Pillman loose cannon era? That's a bunch of different questions there. Do I think he should be in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. And I think at some point he will be. Next year is going to be 20 years, which is kind of crazy. I've told the story before about how what I was doing when I found out about Pillman's death. I was calling into a wrestling hotline from a hotel room somewhere. I was away from my birthday. I wasn't even watching the pay-per-view that night, so I had no idea what was going on. This was pre-social media, pre-smartphones. How did we all function back then? I have no idea. Dave Meltzer, I know, was close friends with Brian Pillman. He said Pillman wanted to go back to WCW. He was planning, at the end of his contract, to go back to WCW. So I think that's likely where he would have ended up, and they wouldn't have known what to do with him, and I think that would have ended very badly for Brian Pillman had he gone back there. Although, no worse than how things ended up for him anyway. His ankle was all fucked up. His ankle was fused together from the car accident that he was in. He was in a lot of pain. He wouldn't have been able to wrestle for very much longer, I don't think. I think he would have done well to transition over as an announcer. In fact, I think he could have gotten that spot that Taz got on SmackDown had he gone back to WWE after WCW folded. And I think he would have done very well for himself. And if that accident never happened. So let's take this back even further. Let's say the car accident with the Humvee that he wrecked, let's say that never happened and he's healthy. He would have been a natural first opponent for Steve Austin coming out of that WrestleMania 14 show instead of Dude Love. And I think the two of them could have feuded for months for the championship and maybe even swapped it back and forth. I mean, that I think was the only shot of Brian Pillman ever being WWE champion. I think that scenario I just mentioned where maybe Austin drops it to him quickly and then he quickly wins it back the next night or the next month. That's probably the best shot Pillman would have had, a healthy Pillman, to be the champion. But, I mean, that would have been a natural feud. As far as the whole Punk era versus Pillman era, I don't think there was such a thing as a Pillman era. You know, the stuff with Punk was supposed to represent this big sea change in WWE, and the one big change I think it did help make, and Punk and Daniel Bryan both deserve a lot of credit for this, and I think this is part of their legacy in wrestling. It helped change the way WWE views smaller wrestlers, like smaller indie wrestlers. They used to thumb their nose at them. They would hardly ever hire them. I mean, you could tell. You don't have to be on the inside to know this. Just look at their hiring process. They're hiring everybody they can find from the indies. They're partnering with the indies. They're having these cruiserweight global tournament matches on the indies. It is a completely different mentality than the one they had even just 5 years ago. And Punk and Bryan and the success that they had in getting over the way they did had as much to do with them changing their minds and changing their attitudes as anything. It wasn't like Vince McMahon woke up one day or Triple H woke up one day and said, "Hey, we're doing this all wrong. Let's go partner with Progress. Let's go partner with Evolve. Hey, Gabe, give Gabe a call. See what he's up to. Maybe he wants to get a cup of coffee." Of course not. Of course not. They saw what happened with Punk. They saw what happened with Bryan. And that helped open their eyes up a lot. That's why I say that. That's a big part of their legacy, I think, when people look back on them and the impact that they made on that company. And, you know, had they not gotten over the way they did, I don't know that NXT would exist in its current form. I don't know that they would be bringing in guys like Samoa Joe and Austin Aries and Johnny Gargano. That's the change that Punk helped, you know, sort of usher in. Brian Pillman, he didn't really change anything. He got himself over. That's what he did. He got himself over. He convinced people that he was fucking nuts. You know, WWE was already barreling toward the Attitude Era, but that would have happened, I think, with or without Brian Pillman. So I don't think it's fair to really compare the two and say which era was better. You know, Punk was hotter. He drew more money. But it's not fair because Pillman spent more time on the injured list than he did actually wrestling for WWE while he was there. Had he been healthy and had he had those big-time matches, that would be a more interesting kind of buy or sell question. But you can't really compare the two because Pillman was hurt most of the time. Ben from Plymouth, UK. I'm a fairly new listener, so sorry if you've addressed this before, but I was wondering if the plan for Roman Reigns would have been the same if Seth Rollins had not gotten injured. Was Reigns always going to end up as the guy? How do you think it would have gone if Seth was around for the Rumble and for WrestleMania? Good question. I think Reigns was always going to be the guy no matter what. I think he was supposed to win the championship at Survivor Series because they had the match and the match never happened. I think he was supposed to win the title there. Probably would have been a rematch at TLC and Reigns would have beaten him again. And I think the Authority would have still had Reigns defending the championship in the Royal Rumble match. And at the end, probably would have either been Seth Rollins eliminating Triple H or Triple H eliminating Seth Rollins. And that would have led to a match between the two of them at WrestleMania. And Reigns would have won the Rumble. And then, you know, maybe I could see him defending the championship against Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania this year. And getting the big win to kind of solidify him as the champ, right? Because I still think, I talked about Lesnar and Cesaro last week, and whether you like the idea or not, if you think somebody else should beat Brock or nobody should ever beat Brock, which I think is stupid, obviously at some point somebody's going to have to beat Brock. Brock's not going to be in this company forever. Whoever you think it should be, if they end up going with Roman Reigns, which is probably who they will end up going with, I maintain that it's a waste. It's a victory he does not need. You know, I could see the story being told if people actually liked Reigns, but, you know, he goes out there every week and gets those reactions. I think it makes for a piss-poor story if you know he's going to go out there and get booed and Brock's going to get cheered, but the idea is it's Reigns being the one to kind of slay the unbeatable monster. The story, the visual of the story doesn't work if he's going out on TV every week and getting booed. I just think he doesn't need it. It's a waste. But I could see that being the mentality. We're going to save it for Roman. Roman's our guy. He should be the guy to beat Brock at like WrestleMania one year. Well, they could have easily done that this year. And I think had things gone a different way, that probably would have been the WrestleMania main event. So you would have had Reigns and Lesnar. You would have had Triple H and Rollins. And you probably would have had Cena and The Undertaker if Cena was healthy in what very likely would have been Undertaker's last match. And then Jericho and Ambrose, right? That was, like I said before, probably the original plan going into Mania many months ago, and so before everything got changed up, they could have just stayed the course and stuck with that match on the undercard, and that would have been your WrestleMania card. Brandon from Chicago. I recently rewatched Kurt Angle and Stone Cold Steve Austin from SummerSlam 2001, and after over 20 minutes of pure awesomeness, action, and drama, the match ended in a DQ when Nick Patrick saw that three referees were down and Austin therefore retained the title. This, in my opinion, was one of the best matches in wrestling history that ended in a disqualification. What are some of the best matches that come to mind for you that ended in a DQ? Well, that's a unique question. First of all, that was a damn good match, and I actually should go back and watch that because I haven't watched that in many, many years. If we're talking WWE, because I'm sure there were many, many NWA matches that ended by DQ or they ended on a dusty finish that were quite great. The very first thing when I saw your question that popped into my head was Mind Games in 1996. Shawn Michaels against Mankind has to be at the top of that list. You know, with a clean finish, that's a 5-star match right there. Even with Vader running in for the DQ, I still, the thing with The Undertaker, there was a casket at ringside, okay, because Paul Bearer was managing Mankind at the time. And Mankind had beaten The Undertaker at SummerSlam in the Boiler Room Brawl the month before. So, you know, when Mankind made his entrance, he popped up out of the casket, and the casket stayed there the entire time. So there's a DQ, big schmoz, okay, and Sid runs down, and he brawls to the back with Vader, and Mankind puts the mandible claw on Shawn Michaels, and they're furiously ringing the bell, and Mankind tells Paul Bearer, lift up the casket lid, and he does, and there's the Undertaker. And everybody loses their minds. Paul Bearer shrieks, Undertaker gets in the ring, the crowd is going crazy, so even though it was kind of a cheap DQ, this was still quite a great ending here. It was still quite great. And another one that comes to mind, it was kind of short, but I do think it's worth mentioning here. I wouldn't call it a great match in the way we usually think of great matches. You think of a long, kind of back and forth, big pay-per-view match, WrestleMania match, technical masterpiece. This was none of that. But it was great in a different way. It was on Raw. It was the night after Survivor Series in 98 when The Rock turned heel and he was forced to defend the championship the next night against Stone Cold Steve Austin. Undertaker hit Austin in the head with a shovel for the DQ, but you need to go find that match right now. I know it's up on Daily Motion somewhere. Actually, it's probably on the network. It's probably up on the network right now. Look up the date of Survivor Series in 98, whatever day it was, and the day after. That's the Raw that you want to look for. That crowd, I don't think that crowd quieted down the entire 10 minutes or whatever this match was. This was a classic Stone Cold Attitude Era crowd that made that thing so fucking epic. That and Jim Ross's commentary. Jim Ross's commentary will make anything epic. You can cook fucking eggs and bacon and have Jim Ross commentate it and it would be fucking epic. So you have the combination of the crowd, the commentary, Austin hits the stunner. He's got the match won. He's got the title won. Earl Hebner slides into position. He's at 2.5. And Ken Shamrock yanks Earl Hebner right out of the ring. Because the entire corporation was out there with The Rock. So the people are pissed. I'm pissed watching this when Undertaker comes in and hits him with that damn shovel. The whole thing just worked. It just worked so well. I mean, these were the heavy guns from the Attitude Era. Austin, Rock, Undertaker, McMahon is out there. Like, all the key players are out there. So, to me, those are two of the matches that stand out. Again, I know I'm forgetting a whole bunch. But those are the two that immediately jumped out at me as being great matches. Although, again, great in different ways that ended on a DQ. Derek. There have been many times where a match occurs right before WrestleMania that was so good it deserved to take place at WrestleMania itself. Some that come to mind are Kurt Angle and The Undertaker in No Way Out 06, CM Punk and John Cena on Raw in 2013, and The Shield against the Wyatt family at the Elimination Chamber show in 2014. Can you think of any other matches that were just a few months too early and should have been saved for the biggest show of the year? Well, those are three damn good ones that you listed right there. I can tell you that. I would throw Randy Savage and Jake Roberts in there. Anybody who listens to this show is not surprised by that revelation. I was a big fan of that feud in the fall of 91 into the beginning of 92. I think it's very underrated. To me, you know, when you have a feud that hot in the fall, the blow-off should be saved for WrestleMania. And so Savage and Jake should have been a WrestleMania 8 match, especially with Jake leaving. I mean, maybe they didn't know he was leaving. They had a disagreement, you know, whatever happened. But the way things worked out, being that he was leaving, had they known that, you take these two guys and put them in a Loser Leaves Town match, and there you go. You got yourself a double main event at WrestleMania right there. That and the championship match. Let's say Hogan and Flair. Boom. Done. So that deserved to be at WrestleMania. And not that this was like a big time match or anything, and I know it didn't get over all that well on the show, but the one match that they did do between Goldust and Stardust, they did that on the Fastlane card last year, and Goldust won, which I thought was weird. It should have been saved for WrestleMania. You know, you give those two a chance, because I know that was a match they wanted for a long time. And, you know, you give those two a chance to go out there and have the match that they wanted to have in front of the biggest possible crowd. And instead, Goldust, he was just a body in the Andre Battle Royal last year. You know, I don't know how Dusty felt about the match. He was part of the storyline, if you remember. He was part of all those backstage vignettes and stuff, so he was part of it. I imagine he would have been very proud to see those two go out there on the big stage at WrestleMania and have a one-on-one match, and it's a shame because he died a few months later and he never got a chance to see that. Cody from Oklahoma. Last year you had Okada in most of your top 10 best matches of the year, and I think Nakamura could easily end up on this year's list more than once. Buy or sell on the better match, Nakamura versus AJ Styles from Wrestle Kingdom 10, or Nakamura versus Sami Zayn at NXT TakeOver Dallas? I'm going to buy on the Zayn match. I'm going to sell on the Wrestle Kingdom match. And the Styles match was fantastic. I saw that match. But TakeOver was just on another level. You know, I thought maybe it was just because I was in the building. Maybe on second viewing it wouldn't translate as well. Fuck yes it did. Okay? It was every bit as good on TV as it was live. And the circumstances around it also, you know, you had the hook of it being Nakamura's first ever match in NXT. You know, his entrance alone, I think, was worth the price of admission. Knowing that it was Sammy's last NXT match, he got the big send-off when it was over and waved goodbye in the end to everybody. I mean, everything about that match was pitch perfect. And kudos to the announcers, too. I got to give them credit. You know, I only rewatched it on the network a few days ago, but Tom Phillips and Corey Graves, they did an excellent job. So I think as a complete package from top to bottom, I just think Nakamura and Zayn was more of an experience. Styles and Nakamura was just a great fucking match, but they were both great fucking matches. So they kind of, you know, cancel each other out in a way. And that's why I'd give the edge to the TakeOver match. I think it was a little bit more special. Chris has a fantasy booking question. I usually try to avoid these because I get so many of them, but this one intrigued me. Let's substitute Lex Luger with Mr. Perfect as the co-winner of the 1994 Royal Rumble with Bret Hart. And let's put Davey Boy Smith in the special referee role that Perfect had been given while keeping Roddy Piper as the other special guest ref. How would you book it? Well, first of all, I don't like either one of those special refs, so I'm taking him out. I'm going to amend this booking scenario here by removing... There's no need for any special referees. And even looking back, I mean, they did... It did serve a purpose, I guess, with what they did with Luger and Perfect, but then Perfect left and it never went anywhere. And Piper, I mean, there was just no reason at all for him to be out there, and I just remember being pissed that it wasn't Hogan. So let's take the special refs out of this, all right? We'll do that. First of all, I would have had a match that night between the two Rumble winners, Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect, to determine who goes on to challenge Yokozuna for the championship at the end of the night. So one championship match instead of two. And the story in building Bret vs. Perfect is very simple, right? 3 years earlier, in that very building, at SummerSlam, Bret Hart beat Mr. Perfect. They referenced the story in their King of the Ring match when they did a promo backstage at the King of the Ring in 93, and they referenced it. Perfect said, "I owe you one. You beat me at SummerSlam. I haven't forgotten that. I owe you one." So it's not like, well, they wouldn't reference back to a match that was a couple of years earlier. They did, and they would. And I think they would do it again here. You could do another promo backstage, right? Because they had the King of the Ring match, and Bret beat him again there. So that's 2-0 now. Mr. Perfect is down against Bret Hart. So that's kind of the story going into this match. And Perfect says there will not be a third time. So you get another great match out of those two. We never got to see a Bret Hart Mr. Perfect WrestleMania match. I'm sure they'd go out there and they'd have one of the best matches, if not the best match of the night. And I know, and Perfect, I know at that point was not physically, he was not what he used to be, but he was still very good. I mean, their King of the Ring match, I put that match over their SummerSlam match. And SummerSlam, I guess he was all fucking, I'm sure, hopped up on drugs. He was in so much pain from his back injury. So in 93, he had to be in better shape than he was for that match in 91. But they had an incredible match in 93. I think they would have had one here. And I would do it where Bret wins again. Bret Hart wins. And this time, instead of shaking hands when the match is over, Mr. Perfect snaps. He attacks Bret. He leaves him laying. He was always better off as a heel anyway, I thought. So now you've set up Bret's first championship program coming out of WrestleMania, because I would still have him find a way to beat Yokozuna at the end of the night, although I wouldn't do it the way they did it. I wouldn't have Yokozuna just fall off the fucking rope. It would be a little more dramatic than that. I mean, I would have... You know what I would do? I would have Yokozuna submit to the sharpshooter in the middle of the ring, and it's not as foolish as it sounds. You know, at WrestleMania 9, the very first time Bret ever wrestled Yokozuna, he got him in the sharpshooter. He got him in the sharpshooter, he had Yokozuna beat, and what happened? Fuji threw salt, right, in Bret Hart's eyes. And so what I would do here is I would maybe recreate that spot. Bret's got the sharpshooter on him by hook or crook. He's got that fucking thing on, and Fuji's reaching into his kimono, and he's going to grab some salt again. And maybe what you do, you know, you mentioned Davey Boy Smith. Maybe earlier in the night, you know, they showed British Bulldog with his wife sitting at ringside, because Bulldog came back to the company many months later anyway. If you remember, when we saw Bulldog back in the company, he was sitting ringside with all the other family members for the Bret Owen cage match at SummerSlam. So let's say Bulldog comes back a little earlier than that. They show him earlier in the show. He's sitting, you know, in the ring, in the front row at ringside, enjoying the show. So now he sees Fuji reaching back, grabbing a mound of salt. He's going to throw it in Bret's face. And maybe Bulldog, you know, jumps over the rail. He knocks out Fuji, or at least he knocks the salt out of his hands. And it establishes him right off the bat as a babyface. Want everybody to know, there's no mistaking this. The Bulldog is a friend of Bret's. He's an ally. He's a good guy. And Bret wins. For the first time, Yokozuna submits. He submits in a sharpshooter. Bret Hart is the new champion. And then you can do the perfect match, you know, the rematch with them for the championship, Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect. You can do it at the King of the Ring 1 year after their last match, or their King of the Ring match, I should say. Or if you want, you can save it for SummerSlam, like they did with Bret and Owen. I don't even know that it needs a stipulation, to be honest with you. It could just be Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect for the WWE Championship. It's very simple. Now, in this scenario here, it's like the feud with Owen Hart never happens, which is no bueno, because that was a great feud. But in your scenario, this is how I would have done it. Instead of building around Bret versus Owen, it would have been Bret versus Perfect. Miguel from Fresno, California, buy or sell, in terms of wrestling ability and being both a good heel and a great babyface, Eddie Guerrero or CM Punk? I'm going to buy on Eddie and I'm going to sell on Punk. Punk is very talented. Punk on the mic was untouchable. He was certainly a better promo than Eddie Guerrero was. Was he a better wrestler than Eddie Guerrero was? I don't think so. I mean, I think at their peak, I mean, Eddie at the end was all broken down. But, you know, Punk at his peak, Eddie at his peak, both of them healthy and not hurt. Eddie was a better wrestler than CM Punk. Eddie could wrestle circles around CM Punk. And CM Punk was a very good wrestler, but he was no Eddie Guerrero. And when I look overall, you said, you know, good heel, good face. Eddie was a great fucking heel. CM Punk was a great fucking heel. Eddie was a great babyface. CM Punk was a good babyface. He had a lot of fan support. I mean, I'm not denying that. You know, he had the fans behind him. He'd come out, he'd get these huge ovations. But I never saw CM Punk as being this great babyface. Eddie Guerrero, there was just something, you know, I don't know. There was something affable about the guy. Maybe it's just the fact that Punk always came off as a dick, because he's probably like that in real life to some degree anyway. And Eddie, you know, whether he was like that or not, he just came off as so likable and full of life and just mischievous and just fun and entertaining and very funny. Very funny guy, too. I don't know. I mean, Punk would have his one-liners here and there. Punk never really came off that way. He never came off, you know, personality-wise that way. He was very, you know, I don't know. He's very cold, I guess, in a lot of ways. And Eddie, and that's why I would say Eddie maybe came off as the better babyface. Punk could have been the guy. I don't know that Eddie Guerrero ever would have been the guy in the company. Punk, they had a shot with him when he came back in 2011. If they would have handled things a different way and they would have been more willing and open at the time, seeing all the success that Punk was having in this role and selling merch and all that, if they would have been more open and receptive to turning John Cena heel and making those two guys, like, every era has their... you know, they're good guy and bad guy that kind of match up against each other. They're Batman and Joker, or whatever phrase you want to use. Austin Rock, Hogan Savage, and you can come up, you know, Bret Shawn. You can come up with a whole bunch of different ones. That could have been, you know, Punk and Cena. And I guess it was to some extent, but Cena was the face and Punk was the heel. But I think the other way around. That would have elevated Punk into the stratosphere. And then all bets are off. Who knows? Like, now we could look back on Punk after all these years. Had he been in that top babyface position and said, man, this guy's one of the greatest of all time. And he's a great babyface. But they never allowed him to really get to that level. I guess in a way he kind of had that in common with Eddie, where I don't know that the company ever, they never did, and I don't know that they ever would have gotten behind them as the guy. But in their roles, I mean, they were both, you know, very effective. I just think Eddie was the better overall performer. And that's why I'm buying on him and selling on Punk. But I think for both of them, there was a lot, as much success as they had, there was still a shit ton of potential, untapped potential. If Eddie was healthy and didn't die, and if Punk's return in 2011 had been handled a little bit differently, he didn't get, you know, I don't want to get into that whole thing again with him and Triple H and whatever. And in a lot of ways, they gave, you know, Punk the old Chris Jericho title treatment, where his match wouldn't even headline most pay-per-views. It was still John Cena. I mean, there's a lot of things they did wrong in handling CM Punk. But again, just strictly looking at them as performers, buy or sell, buy on Eddie, sell on Punk. Jack from London, England has a buy or sell. On which faction had the biggest impact on their respective companies and on the wrestling industry? The Shield or the Bullet Club? You have said before on your show how you think the Shield are the greatest trio in the history of wrestling, but the Bullet Club had so many wrestling fans excited when it first was created and still do to this day. What say you? See, now, people are still twisting what I said. When I said that about the Shield, I'm pretty sure I was referring to their in-ring work specifically. I'd have to go back and listen to the clip, but I've heard so many different variations of what I said that's just complete bullshit. But that's not the first time I've heard, you know, what I said to mean something else. But yes, I was a big fan of the Shield. We will see them back one day, I think, even before this year is over. Which group had the bigger impact? Bullet Club still exists. It's still a thing. At least they did up until a few months ago. I mean, I guess now they're called the Elite. I still hear the Bullet Club name being used, so I assume there is a Bullet Club. I think it's just Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks calling themselves the Elite. Maybe the Elite is like a sub-faction of the Bullet Club, but you see Bullet Club shirts everywhere. You don't see Shield shirts, so it's two different questions. I think which had the bigger impact on the industry as a whole? Bullet Club. Now, which had the biggest impact on their respective company? The Shield. No question. Without question, the Shield. Aside from John Cena, they have essentially built the entire company around those three guys, right? Roman is the chosen one. He's the guy to take the baton from John Cena. Rollins, they put the title on him for most of the year last year. And when he comes back, he'll be right back in the main event mix. He may be the best performer on the entire roster. I think it's him or AJ Styles. Ambrose is somebody they obviously don't see as the guy, the way they do Roman Reigns or Seth Rollins, because every time they stick the tip in, they get cold feet and they pull out with this guy. So that's the story of Dean Ambrose so far in WWE. There's an illustration for somebody to put together. But he's still one of the featured guys, right? He's still in a good spot on that roster. He's not in a bad spot. That's the legacy of the Shield. It was a launching pad for all three of those guys, at least two of which are going to be top guys in the company for many more years to come. And when they were together, they carried that fucking company. I mean, where would Raw have been in 2013 and even 2014 without the Shield? It is a scary, scary thought. The Shield and Daniel Bryan both. Okay, you take those guys out of the equation, Raw is unwatchable. You think Raw's unwatchable now in some weeks. Imagine Raw back then in those years without those three guys, without those four guys. Okay? Every week they put those guys in six-man tags, they tore the house down, and they put them in singles matches, and they tore the house down. That's the impact those three have had. Week after week, they made that show. They were an attraction. And then those last few months, there before they broke up, the stuff with the Wyatts, where the crowd was going nuts before they even touched a This Is Awesome chant for a match before they even got in the ring. Nobody else in the company was getting that kind of reaction. And the matches they had with Evolution. So, you know, the Shield has had a bigger impact on WWE than the Bullet Club has had on New Japan. The Shield made them stars. Someone like AJ Styles, he was already coming into New Japan with a big name. He didn't need to be in the Bullet Club. He made it a bigger deal because of that, but he didn't need to be in there. You know, Bad Luck Fale, Tama Tonga, Cody Hall, I mean, they were background players. It's like the NWO. The NWO had more of an impact on their company and on the entire industry than any other faction in the history of wrestling. The original trio, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash. As they added guys like fucking Vincent and Scott Norton and Bryan Adams, they were just background players. So that's why I say it's two different questions. Impact on their own company, the Shield. Impact on the industry, the Bullet Club. So they both get credit. How about that? Instead of a sad tweet this week, I wanted to do positive tweet because on his personal account, at PrinceCGR, Cody Rhodes tweeted about something really cool. And it's something that he and Tommaso Ciampa are teaming up together on. It's a campaign to honor the late Chris Travis to raise money with 100% of the funds going to Cavendish Cancer Care, which may have been, I don't know if they were helping Chris during his treatment or if maybe Chris worked with them before to do some charity events, whatever it was, there was some kind of a connection there to Cavendish. So they are going to be selling t-shirts. They have a design that somebody put together. It's a kid gazing up kind of into the heavens. There's this golden glow that's like shining down from the heavens. And he's standing in front of a ladder with the Dusty Rhodes polka dots on it. So it's very much like the ladder that Stardust used at WrestleMania this year. It looks like the campaign starts tomorrow, and it will run through the end of April. This is what Cody tweeted about it last week. He said, the campaign for the Our Ladder shirts should be launching in the next week. However, I did want to inform fans that to honor the late pro wrestling star Chris Travis, the charity receiving 100% of the profits will be Cavendish Cancer Care. Full disclosure, I never had the privilege to meet Chris. I know in pro wrestling, gaining the respect of your peers is invaluable and does not come easy. When asked about him, a trusted peer of mine said he was a good man. With the industry muddled in social media negativity and selfishness, we could certainly use more individuals like Chris. With at Project Ciampa's help, I am really looking forward to launching this campaign. So it's a really cool thing that the two of them are doing, and by the time many of you listen to this, the campaign should be active. So take a moment and consider buying a shirt to help support their cause. And if you do have said tweet suggestions, you could always tweet them to me, or positive tweet, either way. At Solomonster is my handle on there. Of course, I put the post-Raw poll up when that show goes off the air every single Monday night, so please vote in our Raw poll. And also, if you'd be so kind to leave some feedback for this podcast in iTunes and Stitcher, you can give us a 5-star rating. We are a 5-star rated podcast in iTunes. You could also leave some actual feedback, which is very helpful to people who may never have heard this show before. So if you like what you hear, please take a moment to do that. We will be back with a brand new podcast, episode 437, next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. And we will see you right back here for a brand new Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Whatever happened to real men on this show? Can you imagine, in any other era of WWE, dressing down your top star the way that Stephanie McMahon did to John Cena on Monday night? They've done this with Cena. They've done this with Bryan. They've done it with Dolph. They've done it with Ryback. They did it with Rollins. Remember the infamous episode where Big Show was on his knees in the middle of the ring crying for his job? Tears are just streaming down this guy's face. This guy's 7 feet tall, 450 pounds. He's in the ring crying. He's a giant. Yeah, he's a giant pussy.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio,
TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monster Sound Off.